Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, November 9th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
Joining us later will be Landry Harlan from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Patrick, only one place to start this week. That's with Tuesday's election, marked by very high turnout. And for all that, not much change in the local picture, with one very notable exception, and that was in the county commissioner race. Let's start with that race. And this wasn't decided until early Wednesday.
Yeah, when I went to bed on Tuesday, I guess it was Wednesday morning, actually, at about 1:30, it looked as though incumbent Leo Kakunis was in the lead by a couple thousand votes, and that's not insubstantial. But the Outer Cape towns of Provincetown and Wellfleet still had to report. And once those votes rolled in particular at the end, Provincetown's votes came in, challenger Ronald Bergstrom, who's no stranger to county government. Mm-hmm. Bergstrom's been on the Assembly of Delegates. He's been speaker there. He's been a Chatham selectman. He ended up winning by about 300 votes. So it was a tight race. These are two men with strong personalities, and they went back and forth during the campaign a bit. But Kakunis, as of yesterday, still hadn't officially conceded, but he was starting to move things out of the county office he was looking forward, not forward to, but he was looking towards the fact that he was going to be leaving that office. So again, we'll see. Kakunis had run on the fact that during his 4 years there, he had managed to help the county come out of a morass of financial concerns, and he thought that would be enough. But he said he thinks that people may have voted by party in mm-hmm. this particular case, which was a contrast to a lot of the other races around the Cape. But he thinks that might have been the case here, and that's what did him in.
Kakunis made some remarks the following day about his concerns about county government as Ron Bergstrom was coming in.
Yes, yeah, still speaking strongly about his thoughts about Bergstrom's abilities going into that office. He actually said he didn't think county government was really going to be around under Bergstrom's watch in a few years. Bergstrom shot back and said, listen, I'm here to deal with this with the professionals who work in county government, and we're gonna focus on those issues. He had said that he thought Kakunis was too involved in kind of the day-to-day operations, and that he was going to spend more time talking to the towns about what they needed and do things at kind of a more macro level. The county does have a county administrator and other folks there who are working on the kind of professional level. So Bergstrom saw his role in a different way than Kakunis saw his.
And even the day after the election, Wednesday, there was a regularly scheduled county commissioners meeting, and Kakunis there is in charge there. What was that like?
Well, it was pretty par for the course. I mean, one of the interesting things, our reporter Jeff Spillane, who covers politics for us and did an outstanding job leading up to these elections and throughout, was at that meeting. He saw it happening, and he said, I got to be there to see how this plays out. For the most part, it was a normal meeting. One interesting thing was the third county commissioner. This is the executive branch of county government, for anybody who's not aware. County government operates a $30 million, or roughly their $30 million budget, providing a variety of services to the towns and individuals. The third county commissioner, Mary Pat Flynn, actually walked into the meeting thinking Leo had won and, all but congratulated him on that, and he had to break the news to her that he had actually lost.
Mm. Let's take a look at the bigger picture of the Cape's delegation to the State House remaining pretty much the same here after Election Day.
It does, and speaking to that idea of it not being as partisan in some ways, the Cape is a mix of Democrats and Republicans who occupy the state legislature seats. Bill Keating is at the federal level, the 9th Congressional District, and he won fairly easily over his challenger, Peter Tedeschi, a businessman from Marshfield. But again, in those other seats, the incumbents, Randy Hunt in the 5th Barnstable, Will Crocker in the 2nd, Tim Whalen in the 1st, and Julian Sear for the Cape and Islands. And then we also are represented by Vinny DiMacedo in the Plymouth and Barnstable District at the Senate level at the state. They all won. And pretty easily. I mean, it was usually like a 60 to 40 difference. In Sears' case, it was a little higher than that as far as the difference goes. The one race that was a little closer was the second Barnstable. That was Paul Cusack, a Democrat, going up against Will Crocker, the incumbent Republican. And there may have been a little bit of that blue wave or ripple, if you will, that was in effect there. Paul Cusack, you know, he's a veteran. He's a fisherman. He had some of the bona fides that people are looking for. He worked for Al Gore in the White House at one point, so had some political experience. But it seems that the second Barnstable was happy with how they were being represented by Will Crocker and stuck with him.
And this really speaks to the way that the delegation just historically works together across party lines here on the Cape and the islands. That really it's issues that seem to draw people together that the delegation is working on, things like environment or water quality, as opposed to social dynamic issues. Yeah.
Absolutely the case. They call it the Cape Cod Party, really, is what they say. And I remember maybe 10 years ago when I was reporting on some of this, doing a story about how the entire party, the entire delegation from the Cape really got along at that point. Therese Murray was the Senate president. And we had a picture of them all lined up on some stairs at the State House. Democrats, Republicans, all standing side by side. And that really is the picture that you get of the delegation from the Cape. They have commonalities that they focus on and don't focus as much on the other issues. They really go up to the State House as a regional caucus, if you will. And a lot of the towns obviously share some of these issues: wastewater, crossing borders, traffic, transportation, affordable housing. These are all things that aren't as partisan as some of these other social issues that may take people in different directions.
We saw a very high turnout. Let's just talk about that for a moment. This is for a midterm elections, you know, looking at numbers from Edgartown and Eastham, just quite substantial.
It is. I mean, we were looking at the early voter numbers, and those were pretty high, you know, 20 or more percent of people turning out in the early voting, which ended on Friday. And then on top of that, you had, you know, 60% turnout up to, you know, a total of 77%, I think, in at least one town. So that is substantial. And again, obviously, the national conversation plays into that. That does trickle down to these statewide and even the county offices. But that other than people showing up, it didn't seem like it had much effect here on the Cape.
Taking a look at the state races quickly, everything the governor reelected and Elizabeth Warren as well. That one race, Mara Healey's race, did have kind of a local angle as Jay McMahon was, who I think is from Buzzards Bay, was running against her.
Yeah, he's an attorney from born Buzzards Bay area. And interestingly enough, Healey did spend some time here on the Cape. We talked to her about a week before the election, and she was down here, I think, earlier on for a kind of a cookout at the Hyannis Village Green, and then down here even as late as Monday for an event. So she really did, I think, understand that, you know, the Cape was a potential area where Jay McMahon was known and might have picked up some votes, but she was able to kind of fend him off pretty easily. She's a very popular attorney general, and that national conversation really probably did play somewhat of a part there. She's somebody who has been part of, attorneys general across the country standing up to Trump, if you will, and filing lawsuits, and, you know, it seems like every day she's her office is sending out a press release or a statement about how she's fighting back against the Trump administration.
We're going to speak now with Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Landry.
Good morning.
Landry, island voters not immune to the election excitement this week. What can you tell us about the feeling and the outcome on the island?
So from the get-go, you could tell that this midterm was going to be unlike any one that had come before. There was lines forming at the polls before they opened at 7 in almost every island town. And town clerks throughout the day reported no lulls. Almost every voting booth was full, whether it was lunchtime, mid-afternoon, after work. People were coming in record numbers. We had turnout over 64% in every island town. And one poll worker said he was seeing more first-time voters than ever before. So the national excitement really, you could see it on the island as well. And we had two main island races this time. We had one for the clerk of courts, which is a six-year position and a position where you do a lot of administrative work for the Dukes County Superior Court. You manage the jury system and Something that Islanders will be should probably voted on is this is also the person you go to complain to about parking tickets. So that probably played a part in their mind. And we had a well-beloved Islander, Joe Salito, who retired. He had served for 42 years, so this is a big race. And the winner was T. George Davis, who's an attorney from the town of Oak Bluffs. He defeated Anthony Pyland, a physician's assistant from Vineyard Haven, by a pretty wide margin. We also had a very interesting race for the Dukes County Commission. There was 8 people running for 7 spots, and one person who got voted in this year is an 18-year-old, the youngest probably elected official on the island now. His name's Keith Chattanover. He's a recent graduate of the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School. Earlier this year, he organized a trip to the March for Our Lives in D.C., so he's been very politically active on the island. So that was very exciting to see some younger people get involved in politics this year. And some things that are unique to the island and that made the night go on pretty late but kept it really exciting was we have a pretty unique voting system and counting system in a few of our towns. They count by hand from wooden ballot boxes. One of them is hand-cranked and makes a little ding whenever a vote goes through, and it dates back almost a century. So we haven't switched to electronic boxes in a while in some of these towns, and made the night pretty long, but it's kind of a nice thing to see these volunteers up late, eating chocolates, chatting, and counting. And again, by the end of the night, we were showing record turnout numbers, and it really was an exciting time to be on the island, and a full exciting day for us reporters, and I'm sure all the people who went out and voted in a very, very late night, but we had a great time.
Landry Harlan from the Vineyard Gazette. Landry, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, Chatham Select Board is looking at ways to address what they're calling a seal tsunami, and in particular, how to protect Oyster Pond Beach. Tell us about this.
Right, indeed. That comment was made by a member of the Board of Selectmen this week when in discussing the growing gray seal population here in town. Anybody who's walked the shore almost anywhere in Chatham knows that the seals are pretty common around here. You can really see them in every saltwater body along the town's coast. And that's and of course, where the seals are, there's the possibility that there could be sharks not far behind. And that's raised concerns among some residents, particularly some folks who live around the Oyster Pond area. Resident Elaine Gibbs came to the Board of Selectmen Tuesday. She said she basically won't allow her grandchildren to swim in Oyster Pond anymore after seeing seals there just 30 feet or so off of the beach. Now, Oyster Pond is a very popular spot. It's a tidal pond that is connected to Nantucket Sound through Stage Harbor, and it's where the town sponsors swimming lessons every summer. It's basically kind of a kids' beach where a lot of families go. And she and others are concerned that the seals are there, and the sharks could not be far behind. And conflicts with seals have been common in Chatham in the last decade or so. Fishermen have complained about the impact on their ability to catch fish. And this summer, of course, we had spoken about there were 2 incidents where people were bitten by seals at Rider's Cove. And following the shark attack death in Wellfleet this past September, more people have started to raise concerns about that growing seal population. Now, on Monday, Selectmen heard from a Woods Hole scientist, Dr. Andrea Bogomolny, who is the chairman of the Northwest Atlantic Seal Consortium. And she tried to sort of put a little bit of a scientific spin on some of this concerns about the seals. She basically said that, although the seal population has increased since the Marine Mammal Protection Act was imposed in 1972, and right now Chatham is estimated to have about 23,000 seals here year-round, and in the summer that population grows to about 50,000. She said that those seals are part of a larger population in the Northwest Atlantic, which numbers around 600,000, which includes from Canada all the way down to Virginia. And, you know, some of the concerns in Chatham have centered on controlling that population through culling, but she said you really can't do that because if you cull seals here, they're just going to repopulate from those other areas. And without totally exterminating the species, there's going to be no way to control them in that sense. Plus, she said you wouldn't be able to do that because of the Marine Mammal Protection mm-hmm. Act. It would require an act of Congress. There's some thought about administrative waivers allowed in that Marine Mammal Protection Act, but that hasn't really been fully explored yet. Selectmen wanted to do something sort of short term, as a lot of these problems are really long term issues that have to be dealt with in really complicated ways. So they asked town staff this week to look at the possibility of erecting a net or other barriers around the Oyster Pond swimming beach. It's a pretty discreet area. It could probably be enclosed fairly simply. There was some skepticism about whether that would work. Shireen Davis, a member of the Board of Selectmen, whose family operates fish weirs in Nantucket Sound, said they've been dealing with seals getting in and out of their weir nets really since the 1980s. And she said seals are very clever and smart. They figure out ways around these things. But she's also raised some concerns for town staff who have to deal with the disposal of seal carcasses, which is becoming a more common occurrence around town on the beaches. So she asked the town to develop some safety protocols from that. And the selectmen also asked the staff to develop some public education campaigns and possibly impose fines for people feeding seals at town landings. There's already fines under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, but they want to go even further and impose local fines, maybe even revoke permits of charter fishing boats who allow people to feed seals at town landings. So that's the first step that selectmen want to take is address those issues and see if they can have at least one beach in town, Oyster Pond, where people will feel safe from both seals and sharks. Mm.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, a murder trial in Barnstable Superior Court this week. The outcome here was never really in question in terms of guilt, but it was more a question about the severity of the sentence.
No, as a matter of fact, Kelly Ridley Jr.'s attorney, he was on trial for the killing of Thomas Russell Jr. Back in 2016. His attorney essentially conceded that he did kill Russell. He did concede that he did kill Russell and stabbed another man during this fight at this party in Hyannis, again, October 22nd, 2016. At the very beginning of the trial, he said that. He said he's guilty of that, but the question became whether it was going to be something that he was premeditated, that he intended to do, and that would go to whether or not it was a first-degree, second-degree, or manslaughter conviction. In the end, the jury, after about 4.5 hours on Tuesday, I think it was Monday into Tuesday, came back with a guilty finding, and it was a first-degree murder finding. And that comes with a mandatory life sentence. There was, you know, a lot of, obviously, testimony that came from this party. There were a lot of witnesses, and I think that was one of the reasons why Ridley's attorney wasn't really fighting the fact that it happened, but was just arguing over kind of what kind of charge it should be that he's found guilty of. And so that mandatory life sentence is in effect. It does trigger an automatic appeal to the Supreme Judicial Court. Any first degree murder conviction goes to the Supreme Judicial Court right away, or automatically, not right away. It could be a year and a half or so before that happens. So we'll see where that goes. But again, there was a lot of evidence. There was a lot of testimony that went to the fact that this happened, and it would just be a question of whether the jury found correctly on the first degree finding.
And obviously, this is a tragedy all the way around here for everyone involved. But the emotional victim impact statement was really highlighted here in your coverage, and very powerful.
Yeah, Russell's mother said that, you know, the impact to her family had been horrendous. And, you know, even just a week before he died, she and her son had had dinner. They went to the beach. Afterward, they talked, and she said that's the kind of son he was. He never missed a birthday or Mother's Day, a holiday, and said he was excited about becoming an uncle. And that was something that's not going to happen or didn't happen, obviously. So she wanted the judge to know and that this was something that had affected her family very deeply, as did other family members.
Patrick, new estimates from scientists lower the number of right whales left in existence. It's not surprising news, but it does reinforce our awareness of the plight of these animals.
Yeah, our reporter Marianne Bragg for the last year or two has been reporting on a high number of right whale deaths. This is an extremely endangered species, and low or no births. And that's the kind of not almost as important a factor is the lack of births from last year's birthing season. And there had been 17 deaths in U.S. and Canadian waters in the past year, and that had raised a lot of alarm. But this group, the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium, which gets together every year and develops these estimates based on models, it's important to point out, according to Center for Coastal Studies right whale expert Charles Stormy Mayo, that the number that they came up with isn't, you know, the public shouldn't consider that an exact number. It's an estimate, but they said 411 whales, existed according to that estimate. That's down from 451 previously, so a drop of 40. And the reasons for these whales dying are pretty obvious to everybody. There's entanglements in fishing gear, ship strikes seemingly to a lesser degree, but those are the real reasons that this is happening. And so there's efforts being made in the U.S. And then more specifically now in Canada, where they're trying to address specifically the fishing gear issue. There's already kind of slowdowns for ships in areas where right whales are known to be. But the fishing gear is really the issue, it sounds like, and having those lines in the water that these whales run into. There's been three white right whale deaths documented so far this year, all in U.S. waters, and all linked to entanglement in fishing gear and fishing lines. So that's something that they're looking at, trying to figure out how to address that.
And there were just 5 calves known to be born in 2017, no calves known to be born last year. So scientists looking towards this coming season, which really begins as we turn the corner into January and February, toward looking to find out if the calving population is going to rebound.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mayo had said that when you have a year where there are no births or almost no births, the next year you really do expect a large number of births. 20 or 30 is what he was saying could be possible. But I think that's assuming, you know, everything else is kind of perfectly lined up in terms of how these things happen. And certainly there are other factors that go into where these whales are and their breeding and other habits, their food source and where that is can play a factor, and the amount of food out there. So we'll see how it goes. Obviously, a lot of scientists, environmentalists have their fingers crossed that it's going to be a big calving season, and we'll be following along, and Marianne will certainly be following along to find out.
We're going to speak now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Casey, the town of Truro is wrestling with the question of how big is a big house, and should there be limits on the sizes of houses? Tell us what's going on here.
Okay, yeah. This is a story about the Truro ZBA considering a variance to allow a home on Cape Cod Bay to expand from 4,300 square feet to 7,400 square feet. But it's also a story more generally about McMansions and the broader question of what they may or may not do to the community. And this broader issue was articulated by a neighbor of the home in question going before the ZBA on Thornley Meadow Road. The neighbor's name is Joan Holt, and she addressed the ZBA at their Monday meeting, and it was, I think, at least the fourth meeting on this application. And Joan Holt said allowing these homes does have an effect on the broader community, and here's exactly what she said. She kind of really gave it to him. She said, from the top of their hill, it will look like a manor house looking down at the surfs. This kind of thing is changing the community. Sorry, hold on.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thing is changing the community, forcing people out because of the value of land has gone sky high. And then she also says, I always assumed that this board worked for the people of Truro, not the variance applicant. But the board has mostly served the applicants, and it's very rare in the records of this board going back decades that is acted on behalf of the abutters. So her quotes were definitely rebutted by the members of the ZBA, who said it's not our job to make the bylaws. That's the job of town meeting, to try to limit house sizes. And in fact, on Tuesday, November 13th, there is a special town meeting in Truro that will take up the question of limiting house size based on the size of a lot. And it's a minimum. It's based on the size of the lot, and it's a sliding scale. So if you have the minimum lot size in Truro of a 3/4 acre, this bylaw would limit the square footage to 3,600 square feet. And that would increase by an extra 300 square feet per acre of lot size. A homeowner could also apply for a special permit to exceed that by 1,000 square feet. And if you look at the Latenders example, and then these are the applicants in the story in question, they are actually grandfathered because they've already put in their application. But if they weren't grandfathered, this bylaw would actually limit their home with the 1,000 square foot special permit to 5,778 square feet.
And you said it's over 7,000 the way it's proposed now.
Right. They would like to go to 7,400 square feet.
What's the feeling in town about the upcoming meeting about this, do you think?
Truro has been through so many of these debates that last year, they did pass a similar house limit within the Cape Cod National Seashore. So I think there's a lot of support for this, I would say, but with a zoning board decision, of course, you do need the supermajority, so who knows if they will be able to achieve that.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, the owner of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, got some good news from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and then the very next day had another unscheduled shutdown. Tell us about what's happening here.
Yeah, Pilgrim was forced to reduce its power, and not forced to. They did it voluntarily to 35% last week to figure out why a valve in the feed water system there that regulates water flow into the reactor was having problems. Just the day before, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had announced that the plant had successfully addressed 45 items on a larger list of plant deficiencies, including those in the area of kind of equipment reliability. And so, you know, it wasn't, I think that press release about them addressing those issues, or the statement about them addressing those issues, came in again the night before. We hadn't had a chance to address that ourselves right away, and then this problem arose. So the story that Christine Legere, who's been covering this issue thoroughly, lays out here is both those. They did address these issues. They still have others to address. They are considered in the worst performing category of nuclear plants across the country, Category 4. They are hoping and saying that they will get out of that Category 4 status and get into Category 1, which obviously is the best performing category, by the time they shut down next year, which is when they are supposed to shut down the reactor for good. And so they're hoping that by that time they can deal with these other issues on their list. It was a total of, I think, 156 issues, and they only have 40 left to deal with. Most of those have to do with safety culture at the plant. There was an inspection where folks from the NRC went in and talked to staff, and from that they concluded that most of the staff believes there's an appropriate level of emphasis on safety, and that the management at the plant makes these decisions on a conservative basis. But the plant, you know, one way or the other, has been shut down for, I think, 60 days this year, which is quite a long time, quite costly to the owner, operator, Entergy. And for opponents of the plant and who are concerned about safety, they say that speaks to ongoing issues with reliability and with safety. And they say this latest issue is just another example where they can't even, I think one of them said the ink wasn't even dry on the fact that they had addressed these other issues and they were already having another problem.
Let's talk about the utility company Eversource. It will not be spraying herbicide along its power lines this fall because of a paperwork delay, and opponents of that spring aren't sorry to hear this. This is another story that's just been ongoing.
Yep, they've been fighting this for years. This is the use of these herbicides underneath the transmission lines to keep the vegetation down and not have any problems with it contacting the lines, falling on the lines during storms, etc. The company says that this is the best way to deal with this. They say that the more they can do this, actually the less herbicides that they'll have to use in the long run, and it's just better than simply doing it mechanically or by other means. Opponents are worried about these chemicals getting into the groundwater. They point out often that the Cape is a sole source aquifer. All the water goes into this same place where we draw it up and drink it, and they're worried about the effects that these chemicals may have on people. The company says not to worry. It doesn't really get to the groundwater, that it's absorbed before then. And so this five-year plan is how the company sets up these sprayings. They had filed it with the state. It's the Department of Agricultural Resources. And the plan was still under review. At this time of the year, if you haven't gotten to it yet and the leaves start to fall, you can't move forward with it. They actually needed the five-year plan to be approved so they could get their one-year operational plan into effect. And the Department of Agricultural Resources had asked them to make some changes and then was reviewing those changes. Actually, a sub-panel had already approved those changes, and it was kind of just going through the process of the state's bureaucracy to get to the point where they were going to be allowed to move forward. They said it didn't happen in time, so they'll wait until next year to try and get that spraying done.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll have more in a moment. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. And good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, George.
George, some great enterprise reporting about the Steamship Authority's Lost and Found. This is a story that you did, and I gather it has a personal angle for you as well. Tell us about this.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Yeah, this story came about in part because I left one of my chargers, my phone charger, on the Martha's Vineyard ferry. It was late at night. I was working on one final thing, got a phone call, unplugged my phone, and left the charger behind. And the next morning, I went and asked for Lost and Found. They pointed me in the right direction, and I met John Elichalt at Lost and Found. And John talked to me about the charger, and he said, "Oh, we don't get a lot of chargers turned in, so you've probably lost out on that, but I'll keep an eye out for it." And that got me to thinking, you know, what else is left on the boat? And I have to say that John has one of the more interesting jobs at the Steamship Authority. He gets everything that's been left behind. And there's been everything, the things you would expect, water bottles, hats, glasses, those types of things. But there was one particularly interesting thing. A family left someone's ashes on the boat.
Some cremation ashes.
That's correct. He had to do a little bit of detective work. He looked up the family obituary, and he found out that the person did have ties to Martha's Vineyard. The story started to go around with other Steamship Authority employees, and one of the pilots on the ferry said, "Hey, I know that family." And they were able to reunite the ashes with the family. So that was a particularly interesting one. And surprisingly, there's a lot of canes, walking canes, that are left on the boat. And that one really took me. You know, it's like, how do you leave a cane
and
on
walk
the boat?
Off?
You suddenly, figure out that you could walk without a cane. It's pretty interesting, the things that are left behind, and glad to have done the story. And John is such a great guy. I've seen him a couple of times since doing the story, and he keeps holding out hope. He says, "I'm still looking for that cord, George." And I do appreciate that. I have had to get another charger, though, but it would be good to have a spare.
George, you also have a nice profile of a Chilmark resident who, as a young man, was involved in the Hungarian Revolution, the anniversary of which falls this week.
Yeah, this is Robert Fokosh, and you never know who's living next door, right? This guy has an amazing story where, you know, he survived the Holocaust, the Hungarian uprising of 1956. He gives a detailed account of that to our reporter Rich Salzberg and what happened there. And then later on, he emigrated to the United States. While he was here, he joined the Army, and he was serving and just finished training when the Cuban Missile Crisis was happening. He talks about a chance encounter that he had with JFK at that time. So just an amazing story about, you know, Robert Fokosh and his wife and their incredible journey from Hungary to the United States.
George.
And it really is about, you know, it kind of reemphasizes what it's like, what our country is all about. We're a country of immigrants, and this is an immigrant who served our country. I wanted to say that coming up to Veterans Day.
It's a nice story. You can find that in the Martha's Vineyard Times. George Brennan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Steve.
With us on the phone is Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, the Route 6 bridges over the Bass River are an example of some of the region's aging infrastructure. Your reporter, Kristen Young, went under there with the Yarmouth DPW director, and it's quite a revealing look at the condition of things there. And the photos with this article are just great, too, I have to say.
Yeah, this was an interesting trip that Kristen and our photographer, Marilee Cassidy, took underneath the bridge. It had come up in a meeting, Kristen. It piqued Kristen's interest, and she asked for more information. And Yarmouth Department of Public Works Director Jeffrey Colby took her out to the bridges on a boat. I think it was operated by somebody else, but Colby was there to show her these concerns that the town has with these bridges. These are bridges for the Route 6 over the Bass River. They're state-owned structures. But the town says they're really worried about the condition of these, and the town's obviously in that area for a variety of reasons. And they say there are pilings missing. There's these cross structures that keep it in place, which are wood, by the way. And I think a lot of people who drive over that section of road look to the right, look to the left. It's a beautiful scene. But they don't necessarily think about what's underneath them or, more importantly, what's not underneath them, in that some of these wood pilings and beams are just missing. They're just not there. There are cracks in the concrete where water leaks through from the decks, exposed rebar, lack of protective covering on submerged wooden piles. And you can imagine what, you know, water does, salty water in this case, does to these pilings. These were bridges that were built, one side in 1954, the other side, the eastbound side, in 1970. So they're older structures. Interestingly, when we contacted the state, Kristen contacted the state, they said, listen, these aren't bridges that are high on our list of priorities. They're not considered to be in poor conditions. They don't have weight restrictions. But an August 2017 inspection report by the state lists a lot of the same problems that Colby had pointed out. And so the town's really pushing for these bridges, some repairs to be done to them, or, you know, possible full replacement. Repairs would be in the $1 to $2 million range, according to a state spokeswoman. Complete replacement would be $30 million. But the town also looks at this and says, we're also dealing with wastewater, and if you were to repair or replace these bridges, you could expand the area underneath them. And it's one of these areas on the Cape, which there are many, that are constricted by these bridges, and the flow of water in and out of those water bodies further up the Bass River has been an issue that the towns are looking at. They're having to deal with paying for wastewater. And if you expanded that area to basically 300 feet, it's at about 150 feet, I think, right now, you would reduce the need to sewer some areas of towns and could save the town as much as $20 million on sewering systems. This is not just Yarmouth, but Dennis, Harwich as well, because they're looking at a partnership in dealing with the wastewater issues, and $1 million in operating costs each year. So it's not an insubstantial amount. The town says because of that, they might be willing to chip in a little bit in order to help the state do these bridges. But as of right now, the state doesn't seem to have this very high on their priority list. they say, I mean, there's a listing of priorities, and these bridges both fall very far down on that list. So we'll see what happens. The town officials are going to continue to push their state legislators to take action and to try and get something done there.
Patrick, the Falmouth wind turbines make another of their regular appearances here on the News Roundup. A local citizens group was arguing in court for alternatives to shutting these two turbines down, and that legal case appears to have reached its end, perhaps?
Yeah, and not just that legal case. Most of the legal cases involving these two turbines appear to be more or less done, at least in their current locations. This is Wind 1, Wind 2 at the Falmouth Wastewater Treatment Facility. As you said, we've talked about these quite a bit. They were ordered shut down by a judge in 2017. One of them's been shut down since 2015, since not getting a necessary permit that it needed. They had been put in operation back in 2010 and 2012 and had concerns from neighbors pretty much from the get-go, who said that they were having health problems based on the turbine's operations. And so this case that had been decided by this judge, this group, local citizens group, the Green Center, had filed a motion to intervene in the case, and they said, we want to just come forward with some alternatives to shutting them down completely. And that intervention request had been rejected. They appealed this judge's ruling to the Massachusetts Appeals Court, and the Massachusetts Appeals Court recently said, no, the judge, you know, he was within his rights to reject that request, and we're doing the same, essentially, or upholding his move. The attorney for the people who are concerned and fighting to have these turbines shut down says that he hopes this is the end. He's been working for them for quite a while, and he thinks that, you know, all these cases have been resolved. They could still see this go to the Supreme Judicial Court, but that seems to be fairly unlikely. The SJC accepts very few petitions for additional review of the appeals court cases. The attorney for the town said he thought it was maybe in the area of 5%. And, you know, that would take a pretty extraordinary effort to have that done. So it looks like this may be done. They are talking, town officials are talking about moving at least one of the turbines, using the other turbine for spare parts, and maybe even moving that one turbine to another location on the wastewater treatment facility. That attorney for the neighbor says that could spark another round of litigation, so we could see start up again if they move it and people aren't happy with its new location.
Patrick, let's turn to Sandwich. Sandwich had a special town meeting, and the key issue on the warrant was approval of a new way, a tax, to help finance solutions for water quality issues.
Yeah, and this was last Saturday. They had this special town meeting, 11 warrant articles. And as we were talking about with Dennis Yarmouth and Harwich, Sandwich and other towns on the Cape are looking for ways to pay for wastewater infrastructure and water infrastructure. And in this case, they came up with the idea of this water infrastructure investment fund. And essentially, they would take 2% surcharge on property taxes. We have had similar things in place called the Land Bank in the past. Community Preservation Act does the same thing. And they would put that specifically towards the town's comprehensive water resources management plan. And this was approved. Voters were in favor of it. And it's interesting. It could be used for other, not other purposes, but other water-related purposes, including upgrading old septic systems at the Forestdale School, Oak Ridge School, and Sandwich High School. So it's something that the town has done and looks forward to using that money for these purposes. They're looking at $86 million in costs to deal with their wastewater, stormwater, and drinking water infrastructure in the next 25 years, and they think this would be a way to do it. Some people weren't thrilled with the idea of adding another, what they were referring to as a tax, and were thinking that they weren't looking towards more taxes and they only had limited funds. But overall, special town meeting approved the expenditures.
A story this week that had a lot of people talking around the newsroom here. This is about a bald eagle that died after an apparent poisoning. Tell us about this.
Yeah, obviously, birds and bird life are something that a lot of people on Cape Cod are always worried about and a lot of people are interested in. In this case, this was a bald eagle, and I think, you know, bald eagles are a bird that, obviously majestic, the national bird. It's a bird that a lot of people don't necessarily always think about on Cape Cod, but there have been a lot more showing up here, it seems like, in the recent past. And in this case, a bald eagle was found sick in Centerville, brought to the Cape Wildlife Center in Barnstable for evaluation. That's run by the New England Wildlife Center. And the veterinarians there said it was really hurt, clinging to life, had a puncture wound, ruptured eye. But underlying all that was something they said was rodenticide toxicity. It had basically rat poison inside its system. And, you know, people are looking for ways to deal with rats. There's been, it seems like, more rats around on the Cape in recent years and elsewhere. Some people attribute it to backyard chicken owners or people feeding birds and bird food that's out there, and the rats get a hold of that. And one way that people are dealing with it is they're putting down this rodenticide that the rats eat, and then the rats die. What happens is predators like bald eagles then pick up the rats, eat the rats, and they ingest the poison as well. And so the folks at the Wildlife Center and other bird experts on the Cape told our reporter Jason Savio that, listen, if you're putting rat poison out there, you're poisoning birds and other life. And the folks at Cape Wildlife Center say that between their Barnstable operation and the New England Wildlife Center say between their Barnstable operation and the operation in Weymouth, they've seen 100 different cases of animals with rat poison over the past 2 years, and that includes red-tailed hawks, owls, foxes, coyotes. And they say there's just other ways to handle it. You could use snap traps, scent-based deterrents, ultrasonic devices plugged into the wall that emit this frequency that rodents don't like. And they're just suggesting that people stay away from the rat poison. They also say, listen, if you have it around, children could get into it. There's all sorts of issues, obviously, when you have a poison around and the adverse effects that come from that. And it really does sound like a pretty horrific way to go when you do ingest it, when the animals do ingest it. Essentially, any cut they have, any injury they have that's bleeding, the bleeding won't stop. It basically acts to not clot the bleeding. It hinders the activation of vitamin K that's used to form these clots. And without that, the bleeding just won't stop. So they basically, the way it was described, you know, stumble around bleeding until they die, which again sounds like a pretty bad way to go.
Patrick, we have a few minutes here at the end of the program, and I want to circle back to the election because we didn't touch on the ballot questions. And there were three ballot questions this past week. There was a ballot question one, which was had to do with the nurse staffing ratios. Ballot question two, which had to do with in kind of responding to the Citizens United decision. And then ballot question three about transgender rights. Run these down for us, if you would.
Sure. On the Cape, the votes on those questions essentially lined up with what we saw statewide. Obviously, ballot question one, for anybody who didn't know, was going to mandate nurse staffing levels at hospitals. That lost by a pretty substantial margin. The other two ballot questions did win, but we had our reporter Cindy McCormick talking to folks yesterday about the first question, which seemed to be the one that kind of raised the most concern among people and controversy, if you will. And the folks who represent the nurses, the Nurses Association, say that it's not the end of their efforts to get hospital nurse-to-patient staffing ratios the way they think that it should be for patient safety. And the head of the Cape Cod Healthcare and the hospitals here on the Cape said that they're ready for this conversation and they want to have it, but they didn't think there were any winners in this debate. And he was this is Michael Loff, who runs Cape Cod Healthcare, said he's was sad that so many people took divisive positions in the lead up to Election Day on this particular issue, but he did say, you know, now is the opportunity to begin a greater conversation about reforming healthcare. So it looks like that conversation is certainly not over.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Steve.
And we heard from Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.